Okay. I don't have a plan for how this session should go. There's one thing I would like us all to do at the beginning, and that's to give a vote of thanks to Lionel and to Pete, whose work in getting all of this organized and in making it run so smoothly has been absolutely invaluable. So I'd just like to thank you. Thank you, of course. And to Stuart up the back there, who as usual has done such a fabulous job in making things run so smoothly. Okay. Here's a possible sort of structuring thought. Several people have said to me over the last day or so, are you going to have more of these things where these things meant EPR conferences? That thought hadn't been in my mind, but since this one had gone so well and since I've had comments of that kind, I'm certainly open to the possibility. So I thought one of the things we might think about is what kinds of topics have emerged out of this meeting that would be profitable ones to try to focus on in a successor meeting in a couple of years. Now I've got some vague ideas about that. One of them, it seems to me, is what Robert calls the no exit problem. I think that's obviously a very deep and fascinating and crucial problem, especially for people who are doing things in this general kind of orientation that many of us here share. I think it would be valuable to try and come up with some kind of a list over the next half hour or so, and see if we can think of that as a framework for doing things in the future. I've got some other suggestions, but I'd rather hand over to other people initially here around this table, and people on the red chairs as well.
Well, Rachel.
Well, so this is something that Crispin was actually suggesting earlier, that it's not clear what the what people agree on anymore and what they disagree on, and kind of what the overall map of the territory is. Mm-hmm. It would be worth figuring that out.
Yes, please.
I might be interested in, you know, discussing the issues of objectivity and relativism, which I think are very pressing in these realms where we're anti-representationalists. We might want to look at those across a number of different domains. That's something I'd be very interested in taking on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then that connects with one of the other things that I had in my mind too, which is some of these issues about incompatibility, negation, the sort of order of priority between the various notions in this sort of area. And that obviously connects with objectivity and with relativism in a very direct way.
Can I add something?
Yeah,
right there. In a paper of yours, you in the early 90s, you made this nice distinction between horizontal and vertical pluralism. And it seemed to me that that's the connection between those two, and explain what I mean in a minute, it seems like a nice thing to be looking at. And this is what I took you to mean. I mean, one idea that I've always found appealing in pragmatist, pluralist sort of thinking is that the idea that there's more than one true story of the world. And what I took away from that paper of yours is that there's two ways of looking at that metaphor. There's the sort of idea that there's more than one true story in the sense of there's an ethical story, there's a physical story, there's a causal story. You know, there's more than one kind of truths that and you know there's a or there's and then there's an open question of how we stack them, how we order them. And a pluralist often seems to think these things as autonomous in some way. Then there's also the question, however, of horizontal pluralism, which is the idea that within one of those discourses, whether there's room for more than one story within that discourse, that is perhaps incompatible descriptions of the same kind. And there's always, it seems to me, a sort of open question as to how, you know, to the extent to which one is pragmatist pluralist along one dimension, to what extent does that encourage it encourage the pluralism along the other dimension. But there's this other issue too that it seems to me that's come up here as well, which is this, which is related, which is this idea of sort of a diagonal, you might say, type of pluralist issue, which is, you know, this issue that Bob was raising and has come up again and again, which is, suppose you go pragmatist or in the meta vocabulary, as he put it, is it possible to have more than one meta description of what's going on? Is that possible? Do we want to be pluralist about our ways of categorizing these things? I'm not sure that's completely well formed, but it does seem to me something I'd be interested in thinking about.
Okay, good.
I mean, one thing I'm interested in is the other half of Humean expressivism, that is modality rather than morality. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've really quite a bit focused on the normative more generally, on the moral specifically. It seems to me there's a completely different set of criteria of adequacy, substantially different set of criteria of adequacy for talking about causal, logical, and metaphysical modalities in pragmatist, expressivist, deflationary sorts of terms that engages with a completely different literature than the meta-ethical expressivism does, and is an equally interesting test bed for thinking about some of these issues. So I'd be glad to see some focus on that.
Yeah, actually, yes. If this prompted by what Bob says, but it goes back to what Rachel had said. I really do have this, perhaps we all have this sense, that people come out of the gate with their projects and agendas, and very often feel themselves to be disagreeing with each other, how to implement this, that, or the other thing. And then at the end of the day, it emerges that we really haven't been asking the same question at all. So we want to clarify the adequacy conditions. Now, I know this has come up again and again. Indeed, my remarks to Matthew today involve this. But I'm sure you all recall that remark, I think, that McDowell makes in the Values and Secondary Qualities piece, where he's criticizing Simon's brand of projectivism, irrealist strategies of that kind. And he says, look, there's a kind of self-understanding that we seek that involves not these causal forces, the stimulatory conditions that prompt you to enter the discourse in a certain way, but he focuses on the need to also see our responses to the world as somehow merited or legitimate or a good way to go on. Yeah. Now, this comes out in the contrast between bunking and debunking. I'll get to that in a minute. You know, Sellars is well known for his militant insistence upon the contrast between matters explanatory and matters justificatory. And one reason Sellars disliked certain aspects of Quine's thinking is that it all reeked of the explanatory, and it wasn't clear what was happening to the linguistic norms, whether the ought to be's or the ought to do's. I wonder if we are in the business of explanation, and Simon, you are incredibly crystal clear on this. You see these projects as explanatory, as do I. But judging from some things I've heard other people say, it might be either something other than that, or perhaps not only that.
Yeah.
So what are we trying to do? Good. Whether I'm trying to do this for ontological discourse, or we do it for modal discourse, alethic or causal, or we go back to moral, or whatever chunk of discourse we're theorizing about, what would it be to do it well?
Yeah.
When would we know that we've won? Because I hear things that strike, I keep talking about no exit, because I don't know whether I don't know what I've got.
Yeah.
And I would like us to go back, and Rachel, I hope this ties up with part of what you're saying, I would like us to go back and say, all right, what did the Boo Hooray people want? Did they get it relative to their adequacy conditions? Yeah. What did the second generation want? What did Simon want? What did Alan Gibbard want? What did the, you know, because I'm not clear that we all want the same thing.
Thanks for saying I'm crystal clear about this. I'm not sure I am in my own mind. I mean, certainly I cast it, and I cast it this week as an interest in explanation motivating expressivism. I think in my own mind there was also a justificatory
leg
to it. Well, I mean, one thing that Well, I mean, one motive for quasi-realism in the first place was to avoid John Mackey. That is, the idea that first-order practice has at its heart some kind of metaphysical or other error, which therefore motivates junking it or replacing it, perhaps with a Boo Hooray story. And I think one, you know, I think, you know, in the context of the much wider kind of pragmatism, which, you know, really has been emerging as a almost common ground, I think it's easy to forget that out there there are people, there have been people prowling around saying that moral talk, causal talk, perhaps even in some respects logical talk, have at their heart some kind of mistake. And you've got to be clear that you, well, I'd like my kind of explanation to mop up any motivation for that kind of thought. You know, people like Russell saying you should do your physics without cause, or perhaps even Hume, for example. And one thing that I've always thought is, look, a lot of people have said, oh, quasi-realism doesn't work, this, that, or the other lacuna in the expressive story, you know, that you can't get a full semantics and it can't be smooth and solve the embedding problems and so on. I always think, yeah, well, maybe that's difficult, but what are you going to do, climb into bed with John Mackey? Because if as it were, there's an impassable step between Boo Hooray on the one hand and what we actually say on the other, then maybe Mackey was right that we should go back to the you know, we should, it's a step which we deceive ourselves if we think we've managed to pass it. And that came up a little bit with what Michael said about the Greeks' problem with normativity. You know, that there's got to be a, what's it, an unnormed norm giver or something. you know, that if you can't get that explanatory story over that step, then it seems as though there's something lacking both in explanation and in justification.
I take this very seriously. I think that just a matter of history, these tendencies have been strengthened by challenges to Helen Wigner's discourse.
Yeah.
Math is in bad shape because it's committed to the abstract. Morals is in bad shape because it's committed to unintelligible characteristics that have to be bizarre and terrible, easily featured. Modality is in bad shape because, well, how could anything be necessary?
Right, in that sense.
Right. How could we know about it if it was?
And
there's something naive about those concerns, but they do motivate this, this broad direction of inquiry, and they need to respond to.
Yeah.
In that sense, it's inevitably justificatory.
Yeah,
I think win through to where we could say, actually, no, it's in good shape.
Yeah.
And there was a mistake of a certain kind made in criticism.
That's fine.
That's justificatory.
Yeah, that's justificatory.
Could I just make a comment just on this point? I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's a difference between, as it were, a justificatory attitude towards everyday uses and a justificatory attitude towards theoretical uses, especially uses by some of our philosophical colleagues. Because, I mean, many of us are sympathetic to the view that some of the use of representational vocabulary in various sorts of philosophical projects is not something we want to justify. On the contrary, we're opposed to it. And no, we might end up wanting to say the same about some of the modal vocabulary. Or we might want to say, as I want to say, that that a proper kind of pragmatist understanding of causation is important for avoiding certain mistakes that, that physicists are liable to make when they're thinking about cause and motion. So I think we want to keep our keep this ironic tendency under control a bit and recognize that, that, that you know, there may be cases in which the implications of this kind of pragmatist outlook for one project or another may not be justificatory, even if the everyday, even if it is justificatory with respect to the everyday use.
To press you both in thoughts on that distinction, there is such a thing as a superstition. Permeates a whole area of thought. You can imagine giving a new story for an area of discourse is actually best regarded as superstitious. It's just nice and neat.
rules.
And very plausible things about the functional role of the discourse and the means it's serving.
Demonic possession discourse works.
This is one of the pragmatic objections to inferentialist semantics, is it's the preferred semantics for bullshit discourses like astrology, religious language. It's, oh, but we have inferences, and so
it's all in order.
The fact that we're not referring to anything, that nothing we say is true, now we know. It's okay. This is somewhat disturbing.
So that needs to be addressed. It's a serious point.
Okay, so we
need a story about when a broad functionalist account of this kind winds up saying, actually, in this area.
I said the EU's a scruffy, a bit worse than that. I mean, what they're for, the regions have vague boundaries, and they certainly don't have firewalls around them. And that's one reason why, even if the EMU were really nice, it might still be the EMU for a bad way to talk. But I mean, of course, one would only see that from the perspective of something else. There's no exit outside the conceptual. I mean, that's one place where there surely is no exit. But there's certainly exit from regions of discourse governed by some EMUs into regions of discourse governed by others. And in the case of Rorty, of course, there's always the thought that this is something that I learned from him and I've never forgotten. Some ways of talking have bad histories, have bad life stories. It's just one crime after another, and at some point they've just got to be locked up for public good. So I think you and I would like to put a lot of representationalist talk into preventive detention. I'd have done with it.
Bob, you were going to come in a few minutes ago before Simon.
Yes. Well, addressing the explanation justification, what are we trying to do? I'm moved by a kind of second order expressivism. It seems to me sort of making explicit what's implicit in this set of discursive practices, which needn't be subject to the same criteria of adequacy as an explanation. For instance, it may be no problem as part of an explication that you're using some of the very concepts that you're trying to explicate the use of. Here you might think of McDowell and modest theories of meaning, but there's a more general point of view, and it seems to me that's a separate enterprise from the justificatory one. But it's sort of the first stage. We better know how it works and try and get some language in which we can say, what are we doing, what are we saying, what's going on here, and then can talk about sort of what, is that a good thing to be doing?
That's right.
What is it good for, what isn't it
good
for? Unless
we know the shape of the practice, we can assess it.
Then we can say, well, look, you'd be misusing this vocabulary if you turned it to these purposes. But unless we know what's going on in it,
absolutely,
we can't do that.
Yeah. Okay. Now there's a whole lot of people on the red chairs trying to make comments. Janan.
That was precisely what at least I had hoped to be addressing, and that is what's going on when we engage in ontology, whether it's about abstracta or norms or particle pair annihilations or what have you. I have been fascinated by those questions. I used to read Gustav Bergman
who used to insist militantly upon the existence of universals, you claim epistemic privilege for these things, it's sort of given that there are universals and particulars and nexus of exemplification. It was all very peculiar. In fact, when I first met Wilfred, he said, "It's good you've been reading Bergman. He's crystal clear, and everything he says is wrong." And this was, I think, you know, this was stuff to focus on. And so I wondered, what would it be for there to be universals? What would it be for there not to be universals? And not too many years ago, I had a big knockdown drag out with George Beeler on this stuff. And he said, there are these universals, there are propositions, there are relations. I said, I need to hear more about what you're saying. I don't know what it is for there to be propositions. I know how propositional quantification works. I know how various formal devices work. I know how sentential embeddings work. But, gee, George, you want more than that. Could you tell me what it is for these things to exist? Now, presumably, I could ask the physicist the same thing. I'm not a physicist, but presumably I could say what's going on when Jones insists that there are muons. And on my Carnap star has a story. My Carnap star has a story to tell about that, and that's the story I tried to share. Where we are undertaking a commitment to engaging in certain discursive practices, and moreover, those commitments are grounded in a sense of what I call explanatory ineliminability. So whether I've got that story right, and I might not, I think it at least touches precisely. Because that's yet another chunk of discourse to which we could apply these irrealist explanatory or justificatory techniques, ontological discourse. And that is what drove Carnap in Empiricism, Semantics, and Ontology up a wall. He looked at these medieval arguments about universals, about propositions. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. It's not that he wanted desert landscapes. It's that he didn't know the difference between a desert landscape and some kind of lush garden. He couldn't figure it out. I can't figure it out either. So, yeah, I'm
interested in a very distinctive kind of subculture within that, which is the physics, which is, I think, distinctive and well-behaved in a way that maybe some of these are.
I see.
Mike, I just wanted to follow up. I think this question about ontology is really crucial, and of course, Robert was, you know, giving us a story on this. But I was wondering, I mean, when I was listening to the talks, there seemed to be, we're giving an explanation of our ontology, what we're doing when we're doing ontology. I think some of us up at this table, not I, think that maybe ontology is one of those things that should be sent out to Alcatraz, like representation. Mm-hmm. And I mean, your claim is, well, that's not really going to happen because it's just not sort of, you're never going to catch that guy. He's always going to escape, or never escape, or whatever the metaphor is. But, you know, there has been a lot of talk about this this idea of metaphysics is bad. We must stop doing metaphysics. Right? And yet there's a certain stance in which, I mean, I guess I'm agreeing with you, there's a certain sense in which it seems that's what we've sort of been doing. So I am puzzled about what's the good metaphysics, what's the bad metaphysics. I'd like to know so I'm not sinning without, you know.
Something that's puzzled me along those lines, and maybe Janine's lines too, is, I mean, think back to David Lewis, the Pluriverse. You know, along comes David Lewis, who tells us that there's really a possible world, and it's just like this world, except it's only possible, and it's got a talking donkey in it. And he says disarmingly, and I was met by an incredulous stare. And of course everybody did stare incredulously, and then Lewis goes and say, I don't know how to refute an incredulous stare. Were people right to stare incredulously? I mean, why not just say, okay, sure, you go around saying that's fine. You know, the world doesn't change. Boxes and diamonds are good things. This seems to be a very good way of explicating their logic of mapping it onto quantification theory, which we all love. Life goes on as before.
Depends on what it would be for there to be.
Yes.
This point in Kripke space that has a talking donkey in it.
Yeah.
Let me know more about that, then I'll know whether to stare incredulously or not.
Well, that's exactly the problem.
But then when I raise that, I get other stares, not incredulous, but contemptuous. Oh, you know what I mean. What do you mean? I know what you mean. Well, you know, Santa Claus
doesn't have it. Barack Obama does have it. Natural numbers that are both odd and even don't have it. Aleph Null does have it. There you go. It's never
go enough. On from there.
Yeah, right, go on the same way. I've never known how to go on.
It strikes me that the emu for Worlds Tour would look pretty neat.
Yeah, very. Right. But, I mean, I'm struck that there's a spectrum of attitudes you can have about these discourses. I mean, I think of Hugh as having the policeman's attitude. There's some of them he really wants to lock up, as he says. I mean, sort of preventive detention was mentioned. There's others that are okay. And I think of myself as having more the sociologist's or the anthropologist's attitude towards these. Yeah, there are lots of language games that we can play, and they work all different ways, and I want to know how they work, not because I have anxieties about some of them, think maybe these things don't exist, or there's something fundamentally defective about it. I think I'm pretty much free of those anxieties, but they're fascinatingly different. Regions of discourse, and I just want to sort of understand how each one of them works. Or I mean, maybe there's some of them that I don't actually care very much about, but not because I'm anxious about the others and not about those. They just don't seem so interesting. But I'm much less interested in drawing lines between the legitimate ones and the illegitimate ones than I am in sort of seeing how all this fascinating stuff works.
I think we've got to be careful. I don't love this talk of regions of discourse, even though I go in for it. I mean, metaphysics is the study of being qua being, it seems to me. And reflect that.
Let me be sure I've got that.
Reflect that into linguistic priority, as Hugh puts it. And it's not regions of discourse. It's concepts that show up in lots of regions of discourse, like cause, like necessity, like norm. They're not regions of discourse. They're interesting concepts that have, so to say, wide trans-regional application. And I think those are the ones we've been mostly interested in. And that's a legitimate, I mean, I think that's what Aristotle meant by the study in some ways, but at least those are on the list. It's the categories. It's not just more prosaic regions of discourse. It's these things that show up all over the place. And I mean, one thing about a certain kind of naive name and bearer representationalism, what an uninteresting story about those concepts, as opposed to, an emu with the inferential discipline, the epistemic peculiarities, and a rich, possibly partly genealogical story about the functional significance. It's more interesting than I'll tell you what, necessary stands for the property of necessity. That's it. Done and dusted. I don't think so.
Crispin, I'm kind of anxious to get some more comments.
Well, okay.
Mark.
I want to come back to the question about the scope of explanations or the kind of explanatory additions. Because one of the things that came out, I thought, in the last 3 days was that there is a lot more variation in knowledge people's ambitions than how far people can explore explanations will go, both along more degrees than a sort of fast track, slow track question, but also in all different dimensions. And so so one of the things that I guess I was really interested in was for the people who feel like explanations needed, so I guess my people are at that further end of that spectrum. What kind of explanation is it? What's it explaining, and why? And for the people who are comfortable without explanations, is it that you don't feel like you need to give the explanations, although they can be given, and that somebody else's job is not interested in? Or is it that insofar as we're engaged in this kind of project, we see that certain kinds of explanations can't be given? The ones we see in the camps, we make ourselves comfortable with not being able to give them? Or is it that the seeking explanations is seen as a reflection of a kind of anxiety that Bob just pointed out that he doesn't have? And pushing not give explanations. It's in some ways supposed to be a response to that kind of anxiety that we shouldn't have. And there are lots of different other possibilities, and I think it'd be good to draw those, some of those out in helping us to understand the different perspectives that people have, the scope of explanations, the local explanations are sought. Since one of the factors in play there is going to be uncertainty about what kind of explanations can be given and how far they can be given, and if that's one of the things that's affecting what we're looking for them, it seems like that's important, would be an important result.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's precisely the sort of, I mean, that whole list, it's precisely the sort of methodological worry that I'm in the throes of these days. I've been, as I told you, or I've been going again through all the classic literature on explanation going back to the 40s, starting with deductive nomological models and looking at the Kitcher-Friedman unificationist models and looking at the causal substructure, Salmon Woodward type models, and looking at the pragmatist von Frost and Achenstein, Bromberger type stuff, wondering, all right, what are my choices here? Are there various kinds of things it might be to explain? How about a semantic theory? How about a straightforward model theoretic semantics for a fragment of discourse? Is that an explanation? Is a semantic theory an explanation? What kind of explanation? Maybe it's merely a codification. It depends on what you take an explanation to be. I have arguments with people who work in semantic theory about what it is to have an adequate semantic theory. Is it a model of psychological, model picture of competence? Is it a map of their psyches when they gain competence? I'm not sure. One risk is that in discussing these methodological issues, one abandons precision, and one doesn't want to do that. One wants to be very fine-grained and say, here are some things we might be up to. I'm pretty sure that Simon and I are asking the same questions, perhaps about different regions of discourse, however you individuate regions. From the way Bob talks, I'm not sure whether it's the same enterprise. I'm not sure whether they are the same adequacy conditions. I know you begin with certain ingredients, perhaps begin with some notion of commitment, that you, or entitlement or license in terms of which you think you could give an adequate account of semantic content or what have you. We all start with the ingredients we love. But what is it to do our tasks well, and what are we trying to come up with? And that's the sort of, I mean, your list is, I think, a very important list.
Well, I would insist that theoretical constructions are not limited to explanatory contexts.
Mm-hmm.
I think Simon said something very useful about this. Simon said he was looking for a perspicuous representation.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, so I think you'd be careful how much you're building into explanation.
Yeah.
I mean, don't overdo and don't misinterpret the machinery.
Right.
So it's more general than explanation. I mean, there are different.
It's degrees. Understanding, but it, you know, it
there
may or may not.
There are degrees to which people are interested in involved in theory,
mm-hmm.
and to the kinds of theories that people are comfortable getting involved in. And one of the things I want to know is to what extent is discomfort in being able to certain kinds of theory driven by thinking that you can't succeed in that given the constraints you put yourself under in this broadly correct. Framework, and but although we weren't, if you could do it, that'd be great. But it turns out we think we can't, so we're getting comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
And to what extent are they principled in some other way? And to what extent are they? Is sort of not being interested in them sort of deliberate because we're supposed to? You think they're only anxious?
Right.
Anxious about the discourse.
Yeah.
But are worried about that?
Yeah.
And so if we're comfortable with the discourse, then we don't feel like it's.
I mean, I have a very Wittgensteinian view here. I think it's very Wittgensteinian, which is, a sort of, you're trying to cure the place where the shoe pinches, where you don't like it, where your characteristic expression would be, I don't know my way about, you know, well, that's the inner mathematics, abstracta, norms.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, you know, think they do know their way about or think that we shouldn't, you know, we don't need medicine, we need more exercise or something. That's, to those of us who worry about not knowing our way about, that'll sound very complacent. And of course, that's always been part of the animus behind my various discussions with John McDowell, that I think that he tends to be very complacent about the normative and a purely observational story, an input-orientated story, strikes me as very complacent about it. Because
But I want to say there's other alternatives. I mean, the shoe doesn't have to pinch for one to be interested in explicating it and getting perspicuous representation, giving an account of how it works. I mean, I really do want to separate that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, John's view, I think you're right, is it's only if the shoe pinches that it's worth thinking about it, and if the shoe pinches, I'm going to give a different kind of diagnosis of why it's your posture, you're walking wrong, it doesn't have to do with the terrain that you're on, you know, nothing, and then you can leave it alone.
Yeah.
And I think that there's room in between to say, look, it's not that I'm particularly puzzled or bemused by this discourse, but it's interestingly different from other discourses, and I would feel enlightened, I'd feel like I understood it in a different way, maybe practically I'm just okay. But for instance, no, it seems to me it just need not be motivated by some sort of metaphysical worry or epistemological or semantic worry about it, that there's something queer or odd, or in principle, how could there be such a thing? You might be motivated by that, but I don't think you need to be in order to want to take on a theoretical enterprise.
No, I quite agree. I mean, you know, perspicuous representation does strike me as exactly right, and you use the word illuminated. I mean, it may be the only shoe pinching that's going on is the feeling we're in the dark a bit, that there should be better lights available.
I feel quite distant from this. I think that philosophy is full of paradoxes.
Well, there's that too.
And a lot of the hooks that get people interested in that have to do with that. We get into knots of understanding, all kinds of collisions and contradictions. Some of them have to do at a very general level with assumptions about knowledge, objectivity, meaning, the kind of thing we're doing in a certain area of discourse. And these are paradoxes.
Yes.
And one thing we're trying to do with these various tendencies is address them. They need to be very explicitly formulated. You need to lay out the ingredients, and perhaps if you do that, they come to seem already self-dissolving in certain ways. And others, perhaps they don't. Perhaps in their best formulation, they're stubborn. We are, in effect, saying this. We're saying that there are difficulties to do with understanding our way about and how we can be competent to Paris, associated with the idea, unreconstructed, of representation. You assume ethical discourse is representational. You've got a problem.
I think
put that alongside a certain naturalism about the acquisition of knowledge and rest. You've got a problem, sir. Something has to give. This is a very familiar shape.
Yeah. But I don't think it's so distant from sort of Simon's shoe-pinching as you might think. After all,
Simon's talking about shoe pinching, but Bob is saying that there's a good, in a certain sense, explanatory enterprise, which doesn't need to be motivated this way. And I grant that. But I think as a matter of sociology, a lot of the things we are reacting to
I agree.
Do have that character. They're shoe pinches. And you could say why the shoe is pinching attention.
Yeah, good. A very nice example from Hugh, I think, is probability. You know, sounds fine. We all talk about probabilities. We all talk about single case probabilities, probability of rain tomorrow.
Indeed.
And then all hell very quickly breaks loose. Paradox comes out. It can't be a finite truth condition. It can't be an infinite truth condition. It's lost. So what the heck is going on?
So that it doesn't have a truth condition. And then why are you using it to guide your action?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's a very characteristic kind of puzzle about, you know, you think of some topic in a rather kind of metaphysical representationist way, and then there's a puzzle about its practical relevance. I mean, you know, the problem of motivation,
possible
in the moral case, causal case. So all these cases have the same kind of structure about the practical relevance of some notion.
Yeah, I've got bad feet. My shoes pinch quite often.
Lloyd, you've been waiting to come in for a long time.
Could I just ask all of you to speak up or use the...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move these.
I don't need it, I'm sure.
We're
so.
Saying one thing for the agenda. What seems to me an obvious one. That, almost all the overlooked although Simon did talk about the funny. The difference between aesthetic and ethical hasn't been touched on much. It'd be really quite interesting to explore how an expressivist, pragmatist approach would deal with the discourse of you know, art criticism, art commentary, art appreciation, and so forth. There's some kind of constraint. I mean, you do have to try to justify what you say, and you can have your mind change, but on the other hand, it's distinct difference from ethics, where you could argue somebody into the judgment that something was wrong. So these two different evaluative areas seem to have that one quite salient difference between the two. And I think just general looking at aesthetics from this expressivist pragmatist line of view.
Could I address that? For reasons that, after last night's abominable film clip, you probably now understand, that's precisely one of the enterprises that I undertook in my book, Art World Metaphysics, that Oxford published in 1908. 2008. The round table is getting to me. I'm older than you might think. The interesting thing is that my project in that book, which is an effort to take the methodologies that we've all been working here for the last 3 days, and instead of applying it to causal discourse or normative moral normativity or mathematics or rule following or what have you, I'm applying it to the chunks of the art world that I've moved about in. So I've got this data, and the problem is that the people who seem to have read it thus far don't hang around in conferences of this kind. They just maybe read some Collingwood or Clive Bell now and then, and so there's this terrible dialectical gap that's opened up because I'm using this sort of machinery to try to make sense of what goes on in the art world in a way a philosopher of mathematics might use this kind of machinery to try to make sense of what happens among practicing mathematicians. So I don't know if I got any of it right, but I do appreciate your realizing that there's a space there that could be occupied, and that's precisely a space that I've recently tried to occupy.
That's not, I mean,
and it's lonely there. It's lonely. So if any of you want to join me there, I...
Well, I get that. You've got his colleagues.
Maybe.
David MacArthur and Paul Reddy, both of whom do quite a bit of work in aesthetics. And David is already strongly associated with you in connection with global expressions. So I would thought David would probably make...
I should like to meet those people very much.
They're not here.
I don't think he's here now. He was here earlier. Well, both of them were here.
Just a comment on this. I've also the impression that there's a certain gap here, and I think it's actually a gap that would be filled by a person like Richard Rorty. I think he's actually missing, and maybe that's a topic on which we have to at least one speaker mentioned him as a neo-pragmatist, and someone on the left. It's very presumptuous, of course, of me, because I've never met Richard Rorty to think I know what he would have thought. But I'm not sure that he would have been, that he would have felt very comfortable at this conference. Because, well, let me make this point just as a concern with expressivist meta ethics, but one could also talk directly about art, therefore it relates to. Well, basically, an expressivist, I see that an expressivist would say two things about ethical statements, such as blah 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 is wrong, blah 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 is good. Namely, either when we express a feeling, an emotion, something similar, or well, and in that case, well, you express your emotion, you express mine, there's no conflict. So this does not give us an explanation or justification for why we use aesthetic discourse. But on the other hand, we use more statements as in order to coordinate our actions. And in that case, just as there's just one word we can describe, there's just one word we can bring about. So therefore, we contradict each other when we are trying to coordinate our actions. I think that's basically what Simon Blackburn says in William Passions. And insofar, indeed, the quasi-media strategy works. But it just doesn't show us very much. Because, well, it encourages a picture of us human beings as either expressing emotions or as coordinating action. And that is just, well, we are much more than that. And we use ethical discourse and other discourse in art and so on for many other different purposes. But the problem which I have is that we can maybe talk about like this artificially published statements like blah 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 is good, blah blah is bad. But I see absolutely no subjects that people like historians, novelists, continental philosophers talk about. Like, what Bob likes, alienation in modern societies, the fragmentation of the self, and so on. All these interesting topics, I just see no way to close this gap. And these are the things that someone like Rorty wanted to talk about. He saw our function as philosophers to invent new vocabularies to express ourselves. And I see this kind of expressivism and possibility strategy and so on. It has to lead to an impoverishment of our expressive ability.
I'd like to touch that if I could. I know I'm talking too much here and I apologize. I really do want to respond directly to that. I've asked myself, given my own philosophical ancestry, where this stuff sits on a larger map. And every time I read through Richard Rorty's Philosophy in the Mirror of Nature, it sticks in my throat when he reaches that point in the chapter on privileged representations, where he cites with approval Wilfred Sellers' remark from Empiricism and the Philosophy of Mind, that in characterizing somebody as a knower, we are not describing them. We are rather placing them within the space of reasons. And despite Rorty's explicit rejection of what he calls invidious dualisms and invidious distinctions, one of which he says is, you know, sentences that represent versus sentences that merely express, he is fully in the throes of that very contrast himself. He read the piece in which I argued this, and he sent me a letter saying it looked like I was right, and here's why he had engaged that. He talked about Davidsonian seamlessness and all the rest. But the upshot is he is stuck with the very bifurcation, which I don't think he ever succeeded in providing any reasons for not endorsing it, but that's another matter. Insofar as we here endorse a contrast, and not all of us do, I understand that, between those chunks of discourse that are given over to saying how the world is versus those chunks of discourse that manifest internal states or manifest gildings and stainings or articulate commitments or what have you. Rorty's got that distinction. I might want to say that people need that distinction. I've tried to argue that, but that's more than I have to say here. So if Rorty were here, I guess now here's my short response. If Rorty were here, he would have to care about this conversation, given things that Rorty has said in various places.
Simon, did you?
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. I mean, I think it's a little unfair to charge the expressivist specifically, or the quasi-realist, with, as it were, an impoverishment of the philosophical landscape, whereby we just talk of being pro something or con it as if it's a kind of, you know, that's the end, that's all you have to say. First of all, one has tried to say something much more nuanced about attitude and practical position, practical postures of the mind, of which there are many. Secondly, I think in the specific case that Lloyd raises of aesthetics, there are serious difficulties, and here's one of them. It does seem to me relatively easy to get a handle on moral attitudes through social engineering problems, basically. It seems to me very difficult indeed to get a handle on some aesthetic attitudes. I mean, how does it come about that a sequence of notes, say the one of the last quartets, can be deep, can actually rationally, as opposed to causally, make you think, now I understand something more about human life? Mm-hmm. At the end of it, it's not just that it gives you pleasure;
yes.
It actually might give you some pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to listen to, but at the end of it, you feel. And you're not going to be knocked off this feeling that you've achieved something. And that Beethoven, in presenting it, achieved something absolutely miraculous. Now that, I think, is very hard to understand at both a psychological level and at a rational level. You know, why that's a good entry rule to the thought that something's deep is going on. Listen to this piece of music. So I think aesthetics certainly has, explanatory places where I'd like to illumination, at present I don't know how you find them. Perhaps I should read your book.
I'd love it.
we
I'd like to say, can I say a word about Rorty?
Yeah, sure.
as one of the two people who mentioned. I think he would love this conference. I mean, of course, he wouldn't be here telling us how the sort of stuff we're doing is, you know, a result of having, as Christian put it the other day, started badly and got worse. I mean, you know, all downhill, all downhill since Palm Energy. But in my experience of Rorty, there was nothing he liked better than to sit on panels like this. I think one thing he didn't want to do, though, was to close the gap between a conference like this and, you know, some of the issues that continental philosophers talk about. Rorty thought that, I mean, if you read his attitude towards his essays on, say, Heidegger, Rorty thought there was all kinds of interesting stuff in Division One of Being and Time, the analytic of Dasein, and I think so too. But Rorty thought that stuff was only very loosely related to the need to be resolute in the face of finitude, or to join the Nazi party because you were having difficulty dwelling under the conditions of modern technological life, and that although, you know, Heidegger might have thought that there was some easy move from his account of being in the world with others to the preferability of a more rooted, organic, why we stay in the provinces, a famous lecture, you know, way of living. Rorty thought that actually wasn't so. That was a kind of, you know, offering yourself an extra pat on the back for your social significance that you didn't necessarily or automatically or even typically get by your interest in these odd issues that came out of the Western metaphysical tradition. So, I mean, I think there's some gap closing that Rorty actually wasn't very interested in doing. He was interested in writing on both sides of the gap. That was for sure. But the thing that he learned and recorded, having learned in Trotsky and the Wild Orchids, was that a desire for too much systematicity for philosophy to tie up your theoretical interests and your aesthetic preferences and your social concerns in one nice, neat gap crossing package. That was just self-congratulation on the part of philosophers who thought they were more systematic than they ever really were. I mean, you know, Rorty was in the business of taking them to pieces, even the people he admired, I think. So that's just a comment on the relation of Richard Rorty to conferences like this.
Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap up soon, but Matthew, you had a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the notion of explanation for a second, because it seems to me that insofar as we are pragmatists or want to sign on with some sort of pragmatist label, the sense of explanation that we should be interested in has to do with explaining practice or action, and that's sort of notoriously caught up with both the space of reason, space of causes. There's this complicated intermixture. I mean, if you tell a just purely causal story, that in no way makes it perspicuous why the practitioners see what they're doing as in some way apt. You haven't really given an explanation of a practice or an action. But at the same time, if you just justify it from the outside, and it has nothing to do with the way the practitioners, what causes the practitioners to do what they're doing, also you have not explained the practice or action. So I feel like that intersection, I mean, which kind of comes in action theory between the intermixture of space of reason, space of cause and stuff, might be kind of a fruitful place to look for the sense of explanation that's relevant to these pragmatism and fire theories.
So if we called the next conference, what is an adequate expressivist theory, which would leave room for arguing about action explanations and the phenomenology from within and all that stuff, all the issues you're adverting to, would that hit it? Would that be the kind of rubric that might take in just that sort of thing?
I mean, that almost sounds like then asking what the relevant notion of explanation is. So maybe if I would rather say something like, what's an adequate pragmatist theory, where that's taken to be explaining the practice in this weird way that's hard to articulate, which involves both space of reason, space of causes, kind of stuff.
I'd like to point out that if we are going to continue this series, we're operating under a very tight syntactical constraint. which is the title of the conference has to have the initials EPR. So it could be explanation, practice, and reason. That would be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But in addition, one of the reasons we have the word genealogy, I thought the idea of a genealogy was precisely a kind of story which does sort of get together the reasons we have and sort of how it arose in our past. So it sort of answers his point.
Genealogy. We really do need to wrap up soon. Kristen, do you want to have a final comment?
Well, quick two extra questions. Rule following considerations, what have they got to do with any of this?
Okay, good.
Semantic compositionality, representation starts with an edge. Okay, because it's account of what the content of a thought consists in is integrated with the account of how the content is determined.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's something the other views have to match. Third thought, I lost my nerve. Okay. Yeah. I mean, these explanations we're going to give, you know, we're going to do it in the armchair. What data are they feeding on, and why are we competent to give any kind of explanation of this kind? Why are philosophers in position to give the explanations that we're characterizing? If they are, then we can track back and say something about the nature of the problem to which we're responding and make it clear that we are indeed separate, but it's not clear we are.
Okay, good. I think we've got enough questions or issues on the list here to keep us all in armchairs for a long time to come. So thanks again to everyone for coming. It's been a wonderful meeting. Safe journey home.
Right.
Mike's comments remind me that...
Before anybody goes, we prepared a little two-minute treat, if you don't mind. We thought we'd continue the theme of the movies, and we'd also continue the theme of the music. What we have is a very, very short clip of a member of this conference who probably travelled the least distance to be here, playing the recorder.
I do. I got to get away from here as quickly as possible. I don't have a good feeling about this.
Moment.